The Business on RTÉ Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
Now, to a man whose job in a way ties into climate change, John Avoy is the general manager of Grow Remote, an organisation that's all about promoting remote work for the sake of rural economies, improved lives for workers and the environment. But John made his name as the founder of Men's Sheds here in Ireland. His story is one of adversity. He lost his mum when he was only 6 months old, addiction and transformation. John, you're very welcome. You're from Wexford. Can you paint a picture of where you grew up?
So our farm was in a small community. I suppose we're kind of up a lane, as we say, with four or five other farms in like walking distance, all dairy farms, but really quiet. Beautiful though, like we're looking across at a forest and up on a hill, Carrieburn Hill, quite well known. So it was very nice to look at.
Sounds very picturesque.
Very picturesque.
But there was a but coming there.
There was a but. I suppose for me, like, I didn't always feel like that. You know, maybe it would have been quite isolating, you know, probably a little bit lonely, probably. Maybe that suits some people, but it didn't suit me.
You would have liked more going on socially, interacting with people, or was it just more a case of those wet Tuesdays in January on the farm and it suddenly doesn't look so picturesque and you feel like this is just the same old every day?
Well, definitely would have liked a bit more going on. Realised, you know, I'm much more of a social creature and working from morning to night without interacting with other people didn't suit me. And it's just, I'd say those cold Tuesdays. I'd say there was a lot of days that felt like those cold Tuesdays, probably a majority of the days.
But you kind of presented as a very quiet existence, you know, in the sense that it was a relatively quiet place, maybe a bit isolated. But you had your own battles in your life and psychologically for you, because things started to go off the rails a bit.
Yeah, that's true. And it's nice to be able to talk about it openly now at this stage of my life. In one way, it would have been a very quiet place to live. But like you said, I was probably leading two lives at the one time. I'm talking about my late teens into my 20s and would have been trying to lead a double life, pretend to everybody around that there was not enough while I was going away and getting up to all sorts of development. Got caught up in addiction, I suppose, to be clear about that, like drinking drugs and all that sort of stuff for the most of my 20s, really.
What did it do for you? What did the drugs do for you?
Oh, that's a good question. They probably alleviated some of those things I mentioned, like the loneliness or lack of connection. Helped me feel part of something.
Did it make it feel that lack of connection somehow kind of doesn't matter at those moments, that everything is all right?
Maybe in the early days, but that feeling would have also wore off. So I was probably chasing that feeling again for a few years without success.
And in terms of the kind of drugs that you were taking, like, were you taking hard drugs? Were you taking cocaine?
Yeah. And like, literally everything. Yeah, that would have been available at the time.
Were you on your own all the time, or were you with a group of others that were taking drugs at the same time?
I would have done a lot of it on my own in kind of an isolated manner. Yeah, to be honest. Looking back, obviously, you know, met people in those circles, but would have been quite isolating, ironically, when I was taking it to counteract the isolation.
Was it very widespread at that time? We don't normally associate farmers and drugs in rural Ireland. You know, we don't necessarily put those two together.
I think it was, but I'm not sure again, because it could have been like, because I was seeking it out, therefore I probably had an unrealistic sample size of the people who are involved in that scene. I suppose, you know, I think it definitely honed my entrepreneurial skills about how to get what I needed to make stuff happen.
It isn't necessarily any good for making money, though.
No,
the opposite is the case.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there's no good financial story out of that time.
Did you feel you were in danger of losing everything because of what you were spending?
Close enough. Yeah, I think I was lucky that I managed to get out when I did at that stage. I'd say another couple of years and I would have been definitely in danger, like proper, like significant financial difficulty for the farm, for example.
Did you have a long period of trying to conceal that from family, from your father or from other family members?
Yeah. So that was probably going on until I was around 27. Well, in fact, I know it was definitely 27 when I went to get a bit of help and managed to clean up, as they say. So I think for the preceding five or six years, I was pretending to hide it, but I think the people around me were a lot smarter than I give her credit for, and they knew what was going on, and they mightn't have really had the acumen how to approach it, because they would have been like a lot of families, I suppose, afraid to drive me further away or to drive me deeper into me depression or whatever was going on at the time.
And what was the trigger for you? You mentioned that you got help. What made you think about getting help, or made you think I need help? What was the first step you took in getting out of that?
Well, I probably knew for a long time I was in bother. Like when I saw other friends getting out of it, and I couldn't really. And deep down, probably from the age of 20 or 21, I knew my, behaviour and attitude to drugs and to all that lifestyle was a bit different than a lot of people. And so in the back of my mind, I knew I needed help. But I didn't try and get help until I was probably, like I mentioned, 27. And I think that was because another friend of mine had mentioned going to see a counsellor. I wouldn't have even known much about that stuff, like counselling or support groups or anything like that at the time. And when I did go, made a difference, you know, and I kept going. Didn't mean I never used a drug or a drink again after my first appointment with a counsellor, but it started a process, you know, that had helped me change my life.
So you decided at some point then that the farming, you know, really isn't for me. I need to do something else. I'm going to do something else. Was that a difficult decision?
Yeah, it was. But a very important decision for me now in hindsight. I think, shortly after, giving up everything else, I gave up the farming. I often joke that I'm a recovering farmer. It's like 20 years since I farmed. And it probably is almost as significant in terms of, you know, the change in trajectory that my life took.
So what did you do career-wise, or what did you want to do?
So I hadn't a clue what I wanted to do, but I suppose one thing led to another, maybe being inspired a little bit by that counsellor I went to, you know, investigate what would it be like to be working, helping people. One thing led to another, from, you know, some voluntary work, mentoring young guys, to, you know, a piece of work in the youth cafe, to a piece of work in the community development project, working with men in men's groups and stuff, which eventually led on to the men's sheds, you know, which would have been a good few years later.
What were you seeing in those men's groups that made you think about men's sheds and what more could be done to help people in that situation?
Well, in community development, our, you know, health promotion work at the time was predominantly women who attended, 80 or 90%. So it was very difficult. Agencies and support services could see there was a clear lack of men attending the services that were being provided. And then that some of the services that were being provided specifically for men weren't really working. You know, it might have been an older model of men's work where maybe guys had to be quite well healed before they could go in and sit in a room to talk about their stuff, as we say. And there was definitely kind of no place where guys who had a bit of time on their hands could come together in a positive way. Fellas probably congregated in bookies and pubs and stuff where, you know, the behaviours could be as negative as they would. They might get some positive stuff like the camaraderie, but they also get negative stuff like where, you know, over drinking, spending money they didn't have, and lots of maybe bullying behaviour or whatever can go on in pubs at times that people don't even notice.
And the idea behind men's sheds, it was already in existence in Australia and you'd heard about it.
Yeah, we were working in a small, in that men's group, and my colleague, my boss at the time, Connor, would have just told me about men's sheds, this thing he spotted online, we should have a look. It's a bit like what we're trying to do, that kind of attitude. And we did. And there was a few agencies down in Uras saying we must try this. But then, unfortunately, it was like 2007 or 8 and all the money in the first sport just disappeared overnight. So that idea went off the table a little bit.
But also the need for men's sheds grew at the same time, because
absolute,
people were losing their jobs.
Yeah, yeah. Suddenly there was like tens of thousands of guys who used to work in construction, maybe had big mortgages, they no job and they had no way of paying their mortgage, and it was affecting their mental health and all that. It was a tidal wave of that, like a moment in time there, you know, at the late end of the noughties. And again, men's sheds did fill that gap, because from a service provision perspective, it was very cost effective. Like any few guys who could have anything from a lorry container, you know, and you could set up something locally, you know, not very sophisticated, but had good, you know, impact.
So this began to take off, and then it was rolling out around the country. Were you massively in demand? Were you travelling the length and breadth of Ireland helping to set up these?
Yeah, I suppose I was. I was lucky enough to visit Australia in 2009 and see what the Australians had done. And the big piece of information that stuck with me more than anything else was the fact that even though Australia had men sheds for about 10 years and they'd be going organically, a couple of years previous to my trip, they'd set up the Australian Men Sheds Association. And as soon as they had a body that was there to support any town or community that wanted a shed, the movement began to grow exponentially. So that's what I tried to do here. I set up like an association to support any town or village that wanted a shed rather than supporting one or two or five sheds. But it was such an idea of the time, like the people came out of the woodwork to help. So I was doing a lot of travelling, but at the same time, there was loads of people trying to make it work.
How many men sheds are there? Because it's become so big.
I think there's... So I would have finished up with the men sheds a few years ago when there was about 300 men sheds, but I think there's about 450 men sheds across the island of Ireland now, which would be more men sheds per population than anywhere else in the world, than Australia. Yeah.
Are you very proud of what you achieved?
I am, even though I suppose when I finished up with the men sheds, it didn't finish up in an ideal manner. So I kind of felt there would have been a little bit of unfinished business. But looking back now with a bit of time, yeah, it's amazing how it is and that it's still supporting people.
Why did you leave, or why did you feel you wanted to go on and do something else?
No, not at the time, unfortunately. I got burnt out. I'd been, like you had mentioned, doing a lot of travelling the length and breadth of the country. And 2014, in particular, the end of 2014, I realised I was properly burnt out. I suppose it was kind of ironic, if that's the right word, that I'd been spending all this time trying to encourage guys to look after their own well-being and took the eye off the ball when it came to my own. Little pieces of work that would have been simple became very hard. We had a team at the time I suppose I was responsible for other people's salary as well as my own, and that would have been the first time I would have had that scenario in my life. And but looking back, like, I was allowing that affect me a lot more than it needed to be, but that was because I was burnt out, you know. So I would have had a lot of the classical signs and symptoms of burnout, or, you know, temporary depression or whatever, anxiety, overthinking, you know, finding it hard to sleep, all that sort of stuff. And so then, like, I was back fully fledged mental health problem again, without a drink or a drug in sight, you know, 10 or 15 years later.
And you're now general manager of Grow Remote. How did that come about, and what does Grow Remote do?
So Grow Remote is a social enterprise, and we're here to kind of build out the ecosystem for remote working in Ireland. We believe that remote working, well, I'm very passionate that remote working is almost a panacea for a lot of our social issues. I didn't found Grow Remote. There was Tracy Keogh, another number of co-founders. At the time, when I got back into work, I was working with a social innovation fund, which is now called Rethink Ireland. Grow Remote came to us for funding. We said no, which I'm never let forget. But when I did see their pitch, I just thought this was unbelievable. Like, it, you know, in terms of getting jobs to every corner of the country, to stop commuting, to help the environment through lack of emissions, maybe to help the cities a little bit because there'd be less people trying to live there. I thought, like, how come it's not developed a lot more than it actually is?
With COVID, the whole idea of remote working, everything got accelerated with that, and it's been talked about, and a lot of places have gone back now to a sort of an in-between and hybrid working and so forth. But do you think, is there a sense that maybe some of the momentum around remote working is beginning to wane a little bit, that maybe it's not driven by individuals, but maybe company bosses who are saying, I think I'd like them here?
Yeah. So I think that's a challenge. The conversation around remote working is all about, you know, are people in the office 2 days a week or 3 days a week? When I would love if the conversation around remote working was about, like, the social and economic impact to rural towns, that people are working remotely to get to spend their time and their money in all these villages instead of in petrol stations, you know, on all the motorways. However, I understand from a company's perspective, you know, that, like, it needs to work for them. You know, we feel that, you know, both managers and employees need a different skill set to be working remotely. Things like your innovation, your camaraderie has to be done very intentionally rather than allowing it to happen because people are meeting in corridors. I believe all that stuff can be done, you know. But we were working in offices for 100 years and it still wasn't perfected. Like, it's literally a couple of years people have been trying this on a large scale. So I think the pendulum will swing, but I also think it'll swing back the other way again.
what are your plans for it? What does success look like? What's the potential for it? If everything went fantastically well in 5 or 10 years from now, what would it look like?
So I suppose, like a lot of non-profits with a mission, if it went perfectly, there'd be no need for Grow Remote as an organisation in 5 or 10 years, that there'd be a new normal, like where a decent percentage of people live and work wherever they want in the country, and that leads to thriving communities, like socially and economically and environmentally. You know, there's a lot of challenges to overcome before we get to that point as well, you know, but that would be the ideal. You know, and even from a city's perspective, I think it's a great opportunity for cities to reimagine themselves and maybe have more living spaces rather than roads full up of commuters every day or whatever. So, yeah, there's a big kind of reimagining of society in there somewhere. It's not going to happen overnight.
Sounds wonderful, though.
It does.
John Avoy, General Manager of Grow Remote and founder of Men's Sheds in Ireland. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thanks a million, Richard.